And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to be talking to David Hoyle. We listeners of this show will know that he's a frequent guest because he is an authority on events in Sudan. And last time we spoke with David, we were concentrating on the possible war between the government of Sudan and the new government of South Sudan. And I neglected to point out, because I wasn't aware, actually, that he had just published a major article in the New African about the International Criminal Court. And so we're going to talk to him today about that. And later in the show, we're going to talk to Jacob Leibovich of itaxi.ca about a big event coming up on the weekend. Their guest is going to be Eric Wright, a really prominent and important American sociologist. We've had him on this program. And Phil is here. How you doing, Phil?
I'm good, Phil.
And we're going to update probably a few stories as we go along. I think we're getting David to join us in just moments. We'll have something to say about Syria and maybe a little historical point about history of slavery, which is very apropos of what we're going to talk about now. I think we're joined by David Hoyle. Are you there, sir?
I certainly am, Phil. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, boy. It's nice to be talking to you. And I just told our listeners, I apologize, because, you know, when we spoke to you last, we were asking you about the situation in Sudan of the threatening war, and you very ably gave us the details of that matter, but I had not realized at the time that you had just published a major article in the New African of March 2012, and I really hope people will go and find that article. You also have a book if they go to AfricaResearchCenter.org. This has to do with the issue of the International Criminal Court and whether it is a bane or a blessing, I guess. But the headline, I think the title of your book is The International Criminal Court, Europe's Guantanamo Bay, question mark. And I think the New African very much agrees with you because they featured the article. And why did you choose that, setting Guantanamo Bay against this very prestigious prestigiously titled organization, the ICC?
Well, I think one of the main reasons, Phil, was that for a start, the ICC, ICC is a European court. It may actually call itself international, but it's actually funded overwhelmingly by the big five member states of the European Union. It's actually directed almost exclusively by the European Union. It's an adjunct of European foreign policy. So, but they've been very smug about it. Yeah. And, of course, on one hand, the European Union has actually turned its face against Guantanamo Bay and thinks that that is a travesty of justice, without actually conceding that their very own pet court, the ICC, is itself a horrific travesty of justice. So that's why we went with that title.
Well, you begin by pointing out so many obvious and glaring matters. And you know, we have European perception, we have North American. It would appear obvious from the New African article that it's understood in Africa that this court seems only comfortable with prosecuting Africans, perhaps for subjective reasons, but maybe for larger reasons of extension of power and such. Is that your reading of it? Why have they done this in the way that they have? It's really egregious.
Well, that's certainly my reading of it, but I think also the Africans, and I speak as an African myself, I was actually born and raised on the continent. The Africans, I think, are even more concerned because the big five financial funders of the court, of the ICC, and as you know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. The big five funders of the ICC are the big five European colonial powers within Africa: Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. Mm-hmm. And it's very much, I think, a case of deja vu for, you know, most Africans, because, you know, this in many instances actually presents itself as a new colonization. And, you know, that, I think, is actually a first and foremost in their mind as they look upon the activities of the ICC as well. And also, of course, at the end of the day, there is a school of thought to which I must confess I'm sympathetic, that, you know, the European countries and a number of other Western countries are content to keep Africa on the back foot, are content to continue with imagery of Africa being savage and barbaric and in need of, you know, of white man's magic.
Yeah, the burden of the white man.
That's right.
They need that white burden.
That's right. So yeah. And this, I think, is one of the underlying themes.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to David Hoyle, and you, by the way, I want to tell, make sure you know that you can go to Africa Research Center, C-E-N-T-R-E for the Americans, AfricaResearchCenter.org, and where the book is available, but then you also, it's in the March issue of The New African. And you quote an African scholar, Mr. Mamdani, making the point that this is not a new phenomena, this idea of the humanitarian intervention that actually goes back a bit.
Well, that's right. I mean, you touched on it a moment ago. It's a self-perceived and self-imposed white man's burden that somehow he has to actually civilize or in some cases also the past, of course, actually Christianize, you know, parts of Africa. And this, I mean, I think, again, is one of the issues which is of concern to too many African leaders and many African, you know, politicians and intellectuals. It's a revisiting of that particular arrogant mm-hmm. approach upon the African continent.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you about a specific case which you highlighted in your article as well, and that is Kenya, which is. It's one of the British creations, and they have a parliament. They even wear wigs. They have their lawyers wear wigs. I've seen them in court. And yet, the ICC finds itself prosecuting Kenyans. How did that happen?
That, I think, actually happened because the chief prosecutor of the ICC, Mr. Moreno Campo, is very much a celebrity prosecutor, and he made sort of a number of mistakes in his approach to countries like Uganda and Sudan, where I think his actions exacerbated the conflicts in those countries, and he was looking for another example, and he chose to involve himself in the intercommunal violence that flared up during the last election in that country, in Kenya. And ultimately, he has made the decision, the court has made the decision that the Kenyans themselves are not to be trusted with sorting out their own problem.
They have a political system. My understanding is that when they set this court up, one of the issues was, well, if they have a judiciary,
that's right,
and a governor general, or pardon, not a governor general, prosecutor, a chief prosecutor,
that's right.
That obviously that's not a state that requires any involvement by the ICC.
Well, that's exactly right, and the Kenyan state had actually, well on the way to dealing with that particular outbreak of violence, and I think had approached in many ways the issue from the same position that the people in Britain had approached in terms of our troubles in Northern Ireland. I mean, in 1997, basically, the British state and the Republican nationalist organizations in Northern Ireland chose to draw a line under communal violence and said, from now on, no more prosecutions. We're going to have amnesties for those involved in terrorism and violence. And that was a solution for the United Kingdom. The Kenyan people, however, the Kenyan government, the Kenyan state, have not been allowed to make exactly that sort of choice and draw a line under events at the last election. Mm-hmm. And the ICC has been at the forefront of actually denying that choice. And I think in so doing is going to make a number of problems for Kenyans in the future, because a number of the people who the ICC have indicted are prominent candidates in the forthcoming election in Kenya. So it's going to be very difficult and very, very messy.
Well, obviously, by the way, you're inviting parties to have a civil war with each other, knowing that an outsider can provide leverage for one or the other.
If they choose to do so, and of course, it's not impartial. At the end of the day, one thing we've seen is that that sort of intervention, that sort of legal intervention, very often is actually skewed to one side or the other. You've had example after example already of that in Africa, in the cases where the ICC has become involved. It'll ignore horrendous war crimes by certain governments, for example, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Those governments have intervened there because they're actually very friendly with those governments, or the powers that actually direct and fund the ICC are friendly with those governments. So it's a mess of contradictions and double standards.
Mm-hmm. And there's an element here that you touch on very well in the New African article of March 2012, and I'm sure in the book as well, and this is David Hoyle. The prosecution, the European-based prosecution in the form of Mr. Ocampo, but others, they draw themselves up as almost like angels from heaven with great power, and they're you know, completely unbiased. And they say that they're going to end impunity. You see, that's the main lesson they're teaching Africans. I've heard the speech given by a couple of them. But actually, the starting point for most the great powers is impunity for themselves. You point out the United States is their player in all of this, but they say they want nothing to do with the court, of course, and the court has nothing to do with them.
Well, that's, of course, one of the other contradictions right at the heart of the ICC itself. The United States has consistently said that they will not be a part of the ICC because they say, and it's actually very true, of course, that the court itself will be used for political reason. And the United States actually swore to basically derail or veto any such attempts. Mm-hmm. And having said that, Washington itself has been right at the heart of playing political games with the ICC because the ICC statute says that if you are a member of the ICC, of course, then theoretically the ICC can become involved in your country. If you're not a member of the ICC, they've invented this other way of getting involved in that country, which is a reference to that country from the UN Security Council. And the United States has used the UN Security Council itself to level indictments on countries that are not even members of the ICC. I mean, for example, Sudan. So they've, on one hand, they say it's being used for their political games. And on the other hand, they're actually right at the heart of using it themselves.
The ordinary layman's term for that is corruption, right?
Oh,
it's a totally corrupt exercise.
You also have the other very corrupt issue, which is that, as mentioned, that there are two ways of being referred to the ICC. One, of course, is if you are a member state and you are seen to have engaged in illegal activities or war crimes, crimes against humanity, etc., which you are not yourself prosecuting. The other way, as mentioned, is a referral from the UN Security Council, which in effect means a referral by five countries, who have a vote in that. Three of those five countries who are voting on referrals are not members of the ICC. Russia, China, and the USA.
So it does involve members of the ICC. A god in a machine.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. So, you know, the whole thing is just riven with these contradictions and riven with, you know, corruption. Not least to which also, I mean, it's just not worked as a court. You have full judges of the ICC who are meant to be judging and assessing some of the most, you know, difficult crimes in the world, who haven't even been lawyers, let alone judges. So it's just outrageous.
Yeah. I noticed, by the way, there's another kind of an assumed quality about these courts, which ought to be raised by democratic countries, which is there are no juries.
Well, that's right. That's exactly right. And you are then at the mercy of people who are not judges. In some cases, they've never even been lawyers. You are, in effect, at the mercy of people who are political appointees to that court. And they may have been appointed for a variety of reasons. They may have been washed up politicians. They may have been, you know, people who were inconvenient to have in their state capitals. And you may also have guys who want to have a cushy job for 5 or 6 years in The Hague, or whose wives actually want to shop in Europe.
Yeah, by the way, can I ask you this? I've always wondered, do we know how much they're paid? Because they're paid a pretty penny, I think.
Well, they certainly are. I think the ICC itself, I think, is probably knocking on about a billion euro expenditure so far. And they've only just ended their first case. They've been in existence for 8 years. And I think last month or 6 weeks ago, they actually brought in a verdict on their first ever indicted.
So they conduct a case with one eye on the case and one eye on the budget.
Oh, and also, of course, one eye on the need to actually convict, because if, you know, these are bureaucrats who, after all, are in charge of a huge budget. They realize if they actually fail to convict, all the question marks again would actually be raised as to exactly what this court was for. So that person, Mr. Thomas Lubanga, you know, was always going to be convicted. There was never any doubt in my mind about that. Not because of any issue on the law, but the actual ICC itself bureaucratically had to convict him.
Yes. I recall, David, the beginning of the trials in Rwanda, the Arusha court, I worked there for a lawyer. And what I noticed was the editorial writing and the anxiety of the court was that if they didn't convict somebody, that maybe that court shouldn't exist. You know, they were anxious to convict someone that the president of the court called a big fish. This is the top judge.
That's exactly what you've had with the ICC. It has a bureaucratic imperative to survive. And the only way to actually survive is to be seen to be convicting and to be doing something. Mm. And even then, one of the other horrific miscarriages of justice is that the legal competence, for example, of the chief prosecutor, Mr. Ocampo, was called into question all the way through this first trial. And one of the very few judges who actually is a judge, who has any legal background and legal experience, was the chairman of the bench, a three-man bench on the first ever trial. And he was a British judge, a real judge. Mm-hmm. And the chief prosecutor was actually caught out by the bench, by the judges, trying to hide hundreds of items of exculpatory evidence, evidence that may have actually proved that Mr. Lubanga, the prisoner in question, may have been innocent of the charges. And Ocampo was actually hiding these, not just from the defense, but also from the bench. Mm-hmm. Now, in any other to Anglo-Saxon legal system, Mr. Ocampo may have been disbarred and possibly also prosecuted. The English judge, the British judge, said, that's it. the case is over, Mr. Lubanga, you can walk free. Ocampo, of course, bureaucratically had a right to appeal to another chamber of the court, which he did. And again, for their own bureaucratic reasons, they chose not to uphold the decision made by the only real judge on that bench, and actually gave Mr. Ocampo another chance. Yeah. It's just so corrupt.
Yeah, it's an amazing process. We're speaking to David Hoyle. The article is in featured in the New African of March, and I'm sure you can locate that at the New African site. He's also the author of a book which is available. You can read it online. The title of the article is The International Criminal Court, Europe's Guantanamo Bay? And that's at AfricaResearchCenter.org. By the way, David Hoyle, you can also go to the site. It covers events in Africa, but especially Sudan, at espac.org. David, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the peculiar case of Charles Taylor, which has just come to conclusion. We have these ad hoc tribunals, which are somehow like related. They're little cousins of the ICC. The personnel move around. I notice that you can find lawyers, prosecutors, investigators.
Right.
It's all, it seems to be one phenomenon, but the ad hoc thing has been a very curious exercise, and now we've had this celebrated case of Charles Taylor. I want to ask you this. He was the elected president of Liberia. He was asked or ordered to step down by George Bush. He did step down in agreement with the African states of the region, particularly Nigeria. Then he was arrested in Nigeria for crimes, they said, committed in Sierra Leone. He was transferred to The Hague, where this ICC gave the premises over to his trial. And now that he's convicted, I understand he's going to serve his time in England. To me, that sounds like a penal colony or something.
Well, I think first of all, a word about this this industry. At the end of the day, these courts, and I think your term, cousin or second cousin of the ICC, with regards to these other satellite, allegedly independent courts and tribunals, is absolutely right. What you see in place are institutions, are mechanisms set up by a group of self-selected white middle-class judicial activists, and as you mentioned, they change titles occasionally. They move from one court actually to the other. So we're talking at the end of the day self-selecting, self-declared legal elite of people who are seeking to actually direct and interfere in the sovereignty of a number of countries. The Charles Taylor thing, of course, is very disturbing. I have no brief at all for Charles Taylor. It took actually 5 years for the court in The Hague to make a very weak case against him. But at the end of the day, there are obviously certain heads of state who should, from time to time, stand down, and he did so, and he did so with a large number of international guarantees. Every single one of those guarantees was actually reneged on by the European Union, by the United States, and even by his fellow countrymen in Africa.
So they're permitted to lie to him. He cannot lie to them, but they can lie to him.
It's a terrible precedent, because no head of state now is going to actually risk standing down. I mean, it's a lesson for Mr. Assad in Syria, for example. Again, I have no brief for him. I think what's happening there is a terrible tragedy. But no head of state is going to actually accept those guarantees as part of a process whereby he or she leaves power. It's a terrible precedent, and it'll cause hundreds and thousands of deaths in the years to come.
No, I'm afraid you're right. I mean, that's, of course, all this puritanical talk about, oh, they have to be hunted down and stalked and made exhibits of. I mean, who would cooperate with that if they come with you and to you and say, oh, we're going to offer you an understanding? As they always do, they did it with the president of Sudan. They've done it with Assad. They did it with Gaddafi. It was not going to be based on these gentlemen in the black robes and all that. They can't be trusted.
Well, that is the sad lesson. And that lesson is writ very, very large, I think. Not just in terms of, you know, for our people and intellectuals and leaders in Africa, but throughout the world. You can unfortunately no longer trust the word of the United States. You can no longer trust the word of those states that actually dominate the European Union, because they will change their view, change their opinion, and actually go back on promises as and when it suits them. And that's the sad reality.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about one other detail of the ICC exercise, and get your views too. We're going to ask you about Sudan, but the United States has done something which, to my mind, ought to be noted. That is, they've entered into bilateral agreements. Not only do they say that the court has no jurisdiction over any American, anytime, anywhere. But they've entered into bilateral agreements with smaller states, or good friends of theirs, for example, Rwanda. The U.S. has an agreement that neither country will turn over their nationals to the International Tribunal.
That's right. That's right. And that also underlines or exposes one of the contradictions in the European position. Because, of course, those countries within the European Union, for whom the ICC is a pet project, some experimental laboratory, they were very unhappy at those bilateral agreements, and they saw it as the attempt by the United States to actually economically encourage African countries not to cooperate fully with the ICC. At the same time, of course, the European Union is using its own economic muscle to encourage or discourage, specifically to blackmail those African countries that are unhappy with the ICC, because every single major European Union economic deal made with third world countries stipulates that you also have to be involved with and a member of the ICC before you get your aid or your development funds or your economic assistance. So the European Union itself is using economic blackmail in the same way as it can be argued the United States has used its own economic blackmail.
They might have to pull that poor individual apart between them and the Americans.
Well, it's all so questionable. It really is questionable. And the Europeans, of course, are unhappy with the American behavior, but they're just as guilty of it themselves.
That's somehow I'm not surprised. I is. David, we'd be very remiss if we don't take advantage of the opportunity to talk to you to raise the issue we have to ask about this fighting between the government of Sudan and the government of South Sudan, or the forces under their authority. Is there... you think this might develop into a war between those two states, a full-fledged war?
Well, I've been watching Sudan since the mid-1990s, and I don't think I've seen a more dangerous period of time as the last few months. And I think, unfortunately, I do actually try to be optimistic, but I think, unfortunately, the next number of months will actually probably become even more dangerous and even more fraught. I think you will probably see a return to full-scale war between north and south, but with the rider that it's no longer a counterinsurgency. You'll have two states actually going against each other with conventional weaponry. You know, the South Sudan now has its own air force, it has its own armor units, it has a whole all the machinery of war. So it won't be the war that one saw fought in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
Well, and I assume there's a great suspicion that South Sudan has some secret allies. Some understandings. You know, today's headline, you might be interested, in Toronto Star had a headline saying that Uganda has identified Mr. Kony as an ally now of the government of Sudan.
I actually heard that on the radio, on the BBC radio as well. You know, I mean, it's quite extraordinary, the games these people are playing. Mm-hmm. The only reason why Mr. Kony exists is because of the horrific abuse of certain ethnic groups within the north of Uganda by Mr. Museveni and his government. So, of course, he has a vested interest in externalizing his own problem, mm-hmm. as he has done for a number of years. The other thing also, of course, we were talking about, you know, sort of the danger of taking the West at its word just now, but we have a micro example of this also in Sudan. I mean, Sudan, the government of Sudan came in from the cold. It actually wanted to come back into the family of nations. It made a deal with the Bush administration, and it actually actively pursued, aggressively pursued a policy of peacemaking. It conceded one-third of its land mass to the new South Sudan after a referendum. It conceded most of its revenue-producing oil areas into the south as part of that peace process as well, all voluntarily done, signed and sealed. And they expected, they were told, if you do this, the United States will actually drop a whole range of the sanctions, which actually should never have been in place in the first place, and which are largely economic. And the European Union will also help financially. Every one of those promises has been reneged on by Washington and Brussels. And you now have a conservative backlash in Sudan against the government saying, why on earth did we go down this path? Because not only have we actually lost one-third of our country and the world, but we're back at war with the same insurgents, in effect, that you know we were actually fighting 30, 40 years ago.
By the way, I think a question like that got asked in Tripoli probably about a year ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah. David, right. It's always great to talk to you. It's very, very informative. I hope people get the book. We're very glad to have you, and it was a terrific article in The New African. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
David Hoyle. And it's the book is The International Criminal Court, Europe's Guantanamo Bay, question mark. And he answers the question very well. You can go to AfricaResearchCenter.org and find the book, PDF. And David is a good scholar. And, of course, his site is ESPAC.org, where you can find all the background you need on the situation developing in Sudan. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, or check us out, taylor-report.com. Where you will find interviews such as the one we just did with David Hoyle, and it'll be posted in a few days. And now we have Phil Condon here, and Jacob Leavitt is going to be with us shortly. And I want to, Phil, let's get to a cultural note first of all. You attended the Picasso show?
Yes, I was at the members' preview. The show opens tomorrow. It's going to run through August 26th at the Art Gallery of Ontario. And this is an amazing collection. It is the bulk of the collection from the Picasso.
You know, you say it's just opening. Some people have been seeing it.
Yes, yeah. Privileged people like me who buy an annual membership.
We have a privileged membership.
Yeah, I'm a privileged guy, right? You pay for your privileges.
Yeah.
Right? These are all paintings. The show was entirely paintings by Picasso. They're from one museum, which is a national museum, the Picasso Museum of France. It is the paintings are the property of the people of France. That's not something that Canadians or Americans would understand, but that's how they do things in France. That's right. It's not a privatized museum. So we saw it the other night. Of course, Picasso is in many ways the most influential and the most famous and the most beloved artist of the 20th century. He was a very, very complex man.
That's a nice way to talk about a weakness of character.
Well,
with
many weaknesses of his character.
But by the way, I interrupt that just to say he was one of the most Africa-influenced artists.
Yes, he certainly
openly
was.
And proudly.
He certainly was.
African to his work.
And he developed a lot of different lines of art. There is, however, a particular painting there which illustrates a lesser-known side of Picasso, and it's an extraordinary painting, and it's actually quite well known, and it's in France, but it is not well known here. And I didn't know about it till I saw it, and I said, "Well, look at this!" Right?
I remind you, Phil's a scholar.
No, he's not. But thanks.
You don't know.
But Picasso, of course, is famous for his painting Guernica, which depicts the first use of air power on civilian populations, and by the fascists in Spain in the 1930s. What is not known is that Picasso was strongly opposed to what was called the UN action, what we call the Korean War, which he understood, and I think quite properly, as a brutal intervention in the affairs of Asian peoples. And there was an incident during the Korean War, which we don't talk about here because
the bridge,
the good guys are responsible for it. Well, it's called the slaughter at in Simcheon province. And there is a museum in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea which shows you chapter and verse what happened. Yes, there was a bridge involved. There was a railway bridge.
That's Conry. I have trouble with these names.
Yeah.
We interviewed Ramsey Clark about it.
Well, see, I don't remember. I wasn't
listening. You're listening to Taylor Report, by the way. This is where you hear this stuff.
But what Picasso did is he took a very famous painting by Goya, which shows troops in a war in Spain in the 19th century executing civilians, and he basically did, he used it as a model, and he shows these mechanized monsters, robotic-looking characters, shooting a group of civilians, including a lot of children, huddled together. With very bizarre-looking weapons, and it's called the massacre. Okay, let me just get it exactly right.
And this is in this show.
This is in this show. Folks, you'd want to go to this just to see this painting.
Of course. Yeah. I once went to a show of Picasso's only to see the Guernica. That's why I went. I could pretend I was just in the other stuff, but I wanted to see Guernica.
The name of the painting is Massacre in Korea. It was done in 1951. You can find an article about it on Wikipedia. It does reflect that in the battles in the world between imperialists and the world's peoples, Picasso had a side that he supported.
People need to know that.
And that is something about Picasso, with all of his faults and all of his warts, that people need to know and people should know. And you will see that if you go to this exhibit.
I remember an interview with his wife once when someone said, Pablo, he's such a character. He's got all this money, and he lives, I forget what kind of life. But they suggested it wasn't entirely, puritanical American. But and they said yet he calls himself, a revolutionary. And she says, and the guy said, doesn't the party care about him, and his behavior? And she said, he pays very high dues.
Oh, that's really wonderful. Here's a quote from Pablo Picasso. Art is not made to decorate rooms. It is an offensive weapon in the defense against the enemy.
And so that's Pablo
That's Pablo Picasso. And by the way, they
the greatest artist.
They feature that quote in one of the rooms of the exhibit.
I think that's great, Phil. I'm so glad you went and saw that, because I have to confess, I knew a couple people who went. And they came back and they talked to me about the strangest subjects. And I said, "Did you like it?" They couldn't tell. And they, I wish I had told them. It's kind of like if you send somebody, you know this, send them to an opera. You say, about the 30th minute, boy, be listening because so-and-so is going to sing, right?
Absolutely.
You have to tell them ahead of time. Yes, you don't just say all one big thing.
No, I hope folks would go to see this exhibit more than once because there's an awful lot there, and it is
it's all Picasso,
and it's all Picasso. There is one of my favorite pieces is a bronze sculpture of a peasant holding a sheep that he's taking to slaughter, right? And it's kind of a solemn moment. And it shows, by the way, that Picasso, who, of course, did live a very wealthy lifestyle and all that, was very, very much in touch with the peasantry of his native country.
In fact, he was a member of the Communist Party of France.
I mean, for the last 25 years of his life, absolutely.
This idea that we have to go through his the card catalog and find out what his views were. He was an open member of the Communist Party of France, Picasso.
Open and proud member of the party, and he was insulted by some people.
Don't want the editors of the Globe and Star to find out because
there's a story about who this particular Trotskyite refused to shake his hand and said, "You're not my friend anymore." And Picasso said, okay.
That's the way to ball game.
So that's Picasso Masterpieces from the Musée National Picasso in Paris at the Art Gallery of Ontario, opening tomorrow through August the 26th.
Thank you. We're going to talk, I think, the other subject is May Day. Oh, no, you have an artist to talk about. Maybe we'll talk to the artist a little later.
Okay, sure.
And we're going to talk about May Day. But I want to do something, Jacob Leibovitz is going to be here. And he's the iTaxi man. And we're going to find out about – they have a big event coming up. So we're going to ask about that. Before we get to that, I want to – we had just talked to David Hoyle about this the International Criminal Court. And something very dramatic happened last week at the trial of Charles Taylor. And, of course, I took Dr. Hoyle onto that subject. And he said it was it's a show trial, et cetera, these words to that effect. But something actually happened, which one of the reasons we do the show is so that we could talk about how the major events are covered without being covered. Now, when the court came back and announced that they had decided, to convict Charles Taylor of several counts, not all. Indeed, they didn't convict him of actually directing killing. They didn't directing rape. Even a star, through the person of the New York Times writer Marlise Simons, I think her name is Simmons, acknowledged that they didn't really have him in a command position. But, he's a big shot, so he gets... Now... that's what they reported. However, here's what happened. As the judges read the decision and finished, a judge in the court, Judge Sow, S-O-W, that's right, from Senegal, who was the alternate judge, stood up and addressed the court. And he said... The only moment when a judge can express his opinion is during the deliberations or in the courtroom, and pursuant to the rules, when there are no serious deliberations, the only place left for me is the courtroom. I won't get, because I think we have been sitting for too long, but for me, I have my dissenting opinion, and I disagree with the findings and conclusions of the other judges, because for me, under any mode of liability, under any accepted standard of proof, the guilt of the accused, that would be Charles Taylor, from the evidence provided in this trial is not proved beyond reasonable doubt by the prosecution. And my only worry is that the whole system is not consistent with all the principles we know and love, and the system is not consistent with all the values of international criminal justice. And I'm afraid the whole system is under grave danger or just losing all credibility. And I'm afraid the whole thing is headed for failure. The judges, hearing the voice of their counterpart, did not deter Justice Doherty, I'm reading the names of the court, from walking out. They walked out of the courtroom while he's talking. Then they did something which I, from having worked at these tribunals, I can really appreciate. And I've never seen one of the little symbols that should tell you what a farce all this is that they have curtains. They pulled the curtain between the gallery and the judge and turned off his mic. That's a judge. He's sitting there. He's the number four of the, they had three judges. He's number four. He heard all the evidence, participated in all the considerations, because if one of the three judges had departed, then he would have had to step in. That he made the statement that he felt that they had completely failed and that justice was not served. And he's tried to say that in court. And the curtains were drawn, and it was curtains for Judge Sow. Why didn't Marlee Simons of the New York Times report that to her readers? Wouldn't they have found that interesting? I would have thought they would find that interesting. Why didn't the Toronto Star report that to his readers? You would think that a major judge in an international tribunal says he thinks the whole thing didn't work. No. Did the Globe and Mail report? No. Did the CBC tell you? No. A judge had a curtain pulled on him and his mic cut off. That's not a story to you guys. I think they could have mugged him and they wouldn't have reported it. and that's the name of the judge. I feel like now I'm in Abbott and Costello. What's the name of the judge? So what? No, so who? Anyway, that you. I'd say you better get with it, folks. You are free. You heard about the Occupy movement. You better liberate yourself. I mean, go and find the damned information yourself. Do you think the Toronto Star wants you to know what happened? No. And they're so nervous that they run Marlee Simpson. They don't trust their own writers to get it right. I mean, they got to go to the boss writers at the New York Times, because the New York Times sets, this is going to be the boilerplate, and the rest of you guys will work from this. So they have a big decision. They have to go to the New York Times, because who's going to believe a guy from Toronto? And by the way, if they had a Toronto reporter, they probably would have reported the judge did that, and then the New York Times would have called them and said, you guys are messing this up. We didn't report that, so now you report it. Now we're all going to have to talk about it. So, just do it our way. Just as they do with Mr. Farquhar, his name, that's his name, Farquhar, New York Times. He's over in, Beirut, as the angry Arab says. He claims to be covering Syria. So he tells the readers of the New York Times that the Syrian media has been trying to present an image of complete calm and serenity in the country, denying the reality of the struggle. An angry Arab says, I watch Syria television, and every day they report on violence. They report on bombings. They're reporting it. Mr. Farquhar is about 70 kilometers over Beirut, and he can't watch it. He says, there's one clue here. Farquhar doesn't speak Arabic. He doesn't. He has a guy who tells him. And then he doesn't care. So he tells the readers of this prestigious pile of junk that the Syrians deny to their viewers and listeners. He says completely backwards. They are reporting it as a crisis. So that's you better free yourself. You got the internet. Why are you sitting there like a dope, taking it, being spoon-fed by imbeciles, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, for crying out loud? And find out about Judge Sow. There's a very courageous man. By the way, he's tried his last case, I can tell you. He is not going to be at the ICC anymore. No. He's going to be gone. So we have Jacob Leavitt here, and iTaxi's got a big meeting coming up on Saturday.
Yes, we do. Saturday, May 5th, 2 o'clock at the Cecil Street facility, the United Steelworker Hall, located at 25 Cecil Street. Many of your listeners will know of it. It's also the headquarters for the iTaxi Worker Association. And it's timely. We know we're about to talk about May Day coming up tomorrow and the Occupy movement. And this is really an attempt for the taxi drivers in Toronto to try and look beyond the reform. Some would call it an anemic reform, that the process that the City of Toronto is engaged in at the moment, to try and say, well, even if we make these gains in the next little while, where do we want to go? And we're really excited because our featured speaker is Dr. Eric Olin Wright, who I understand has been a guest on your show in the past.
Yep. He's we're very proud of that.
Yeah, he's somebody I think that
he's from Wisconsin, where they are really smoking. I mean, they may get rid of the governor by a referendum.
Well, and you know, it's why it's so timely. I walked over here to the studio from the Ontario Labor Relations Board, where we've been trying to argue in front of the board for the last 2 years. Get this. Taxi drivers in Hamilton that belong to the brokerage called Blue Line voted more than 2 years ago to join a union. To this day, they still do not have certification. Even though the votes were counted, a majority of them said they wanted a union. What we're doing at the board is having an argument with the employer that says, well, they're not properly employees. They're independent contractors and therefore don't have a right to organize. Well, you know, that's 2 years later.
Two years this has gone on.
The hearing wrapped up today. It'll still be another couple of weeks before they get the certification, assuming we win that case. And that's, you know, that's a big assumption
Workers can be part of the May Day. They ought to be writing, somebody ought to be talking about that front and center.
No, absolutely. And this is the problem is that, you know, you're given a system and you're told, okay, here's your legal framework. Go out and prove that you're an employee and have the right to organize. And you're stuck with it. Now, Dr. Eric Olin Wright is an expert in looking at forms of worker organizations that go beyond our classic or traditional ideas because the nature of work is changing. You know, the phrase they use a lot now is called precarious work. So you're an employer. You can set up your workforce so that they're no longer punching in at the beginning of the day and punching out at the end of the day with their set of rules. You can simply say to them, we're not going to take any responsibility for anything you do. However, you are dependent upon us in order to make your living. Mm. But the reason that we're not going to set this work up like we did in the past is so we can avoid unionization. Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Eric Olin Wright is an expert in how people can come together in alternative forms of organizing when unionization may not be available. And he teaches, as you pointed out, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And they've got probably the best, most inspiring example of taxi drivers who failed to organize a union and instead organize themselves as a real workers' cooperative. And it's called Union Cab, and they've been so successful they pushed all the for-profits out of the market.
That's great. It shows, by the way, people are determined. If you can't have one form of organization, you'll have another.
That's right.
Because you have to organize. Yeah. Now, he isn't the only speaker, but if someone comes, and it's Saturday, what time again?
Saturday, 2 p.m., 25 Cecil Street, free parking. We'll have some food there for you. He's not the only one on the panel.
So by the time people get through that afternoon, they're going to know the whole story.
They should. We've set it up so that it's a bit of a discussion. So, of course, we're featuring Dr. Eric Olin Wright, who I should also mention is the president of the American Sociological Association and notable in that regard as well. But we've got a couple more speakers and a moderator, and we're quite pleased with that. One of the other speakers is former city councilor and TTC chair Adam Jambroni. He's going to talk about how taxis should be viewed as part of the public transit system, part of the solution, not part of the problem to the city's, you know, mm-hmm. transportation problems. The third speaker is Councillor Gord Perks. And Gord Perks comes at this from the point of view that the current reforms and what the drivers have sort of articulated they want in terms of control over the plates in the system doesn't go far enough. He says, you know, these drivers really got to think about their precarious employment and how they can get out of it, so it dovetails nicely. And then, of course, we've got a local journalist named John Michael McGrath, who is going to take an alternative point of view. He thinks that the solution is to deregulate. Mm-hmm. So he'll be a bit of a spoiler on the panel.
He says.
And we're
a libertarian approach.
A libertarian approach, exactly. And then we're really excited about having a moderator.
How about rickshaws? Well, we do have rickshaws, I forgot.
The moderator is a woman named Hamatal Dotan, and she's the editor-in-chief of the Torontoist.
Yeah,
she understands city policy inside out, and so we're really excited, and we ask all your listeners to join us. We think it's going to be a great event.
That's it. But they can go to itaxi.ca.
Yeah, our website is itaxiworkers.ca.
Oh, I'm sorry, itaxiworkers.ca. Itaxiworkers.ca.
Yeah. Very important to add, you know, taxis. Taxi drivers are actually taxi workers. You know, one of those ways we're trying to make sure people understand the links.
You're not kidding the workers. And it is a hazardous life, by the way. You've talked to us on this program about dangerous.
Most dangerous profession in Canada driving a taxi.
You see a trunk of a car and it says, if the light is flashing, call the police. You say, these guys are doing dangerous work.
Absolutely. You know, and it's no coincidence that when you look at the workforce, they are by and large new immigrants and people of color and you know, folks that can't find jobs in other areas. So they're forced to take these terrible jobs. And, you know, it's incumbent upon anybody who gets to make a decision over their lives to try and make some improvements.
Jacob Leibich, itaxiworkers.ca. And it's a Saturday.
Saturday, May 5th, 2 p.m. at 25 Cecil Street.
Cecil Street.
Please check us out on the internet at itaxiworkers.ca.
Great. Thanks an awful lot. And, Phil, I think we have to ask you about an artist, a musician.
A composer.
I'll get there. I would have thought of that.
Yes, this is another historic cultural event in Toronto. The Canadian Opera Company opened a run last Thursday night that'll go to the end of May, and producing an opera of Alexander Zemlinsky. Zemlinsky is a name that is not known in the classical music world, and there's a reason it's not known. He was one of those composers who was successful in his day, but his day, unfortunately, coincided with the rise of fascism in Central Europe. He was an Austrian. He was from Vienna. And at one time, he was a very highly regarded composer in Vienna. But then the political atmosphere really soured in the 30s. Austria had their own homegrown fascism, which competed with Hitler. And then Hitler settled it by invading the country. Zemlinsky was driven into exile. But even before he went into exile, he would find that all of a sudden there was no jobs for him to conducting an orchestra, and nobody wanted to play his music, and this kind of stuff. And he came to the United States in 1938, just ahead of the Nazi takeover of his country, and he never really found his footing in the U.S.
So this is going to be performed.
And he wrote an opera called The Florentine Tragedy. It's a one-act opera. It's over in 50 minutes. It's a wonderful, violent, passionate drama. The text is by Oscar Wilde. It's the last drama that Oscar Wilde wrote, finishing it literally days before he was arrested and got sent on to the spiral that ended in his death in 1900. Zemlinsky said it a few years later to music. It premiered in 1916. It was quite successful and popular for a time, and it disappeared. And it's never been performed in I don't think anywhere in North America. It's certainly never been performed in Canada. Well, it is being performed now at the Canadian Opera Company. It's being twinned with another one-act opera by Puccini, Johnny Schicchi, which is also set in Florence. It was written the same year that the Florentine Tragedy was. And you can see it at the Canadian Opera Company. You can take the TTC or a taxi to get there.
Taxi. Yeah, Jacob is still in the room. Yeah, take a cab.
It's the better way.
Yes. Now, in the time remaining, I want to say that tomorrow is May Day. There's going to be events, and one at City Hall at 4 o'clock tomorrow. You can tell there's a change in the world climate because May Day is coming back all over the world as a big thing and as a an establishing the matter of workers' rights, and their right to the world, as a matter of fact, since they have to produce all the wealth.
Yeah, the longshoremen in Oakland will have a one-day strike on May Day.
They're going to have a strike. Yeah. That's a big league activity.
Yeah.
And I would say that what I'm looking at in terms of May Day, that I think that people ought to be paying attention to. We have the issue of our two nations. Every nation has two nations in it, the rich and the poor, but also we have a nation, country of two nations. Tomorrow in Montreal, the students who've had the biggest student demonstrations in the history of North America, and which has largely been ignored in the English press, frankly, putting it bluntly. I don't want to be like Ignatieff and get in a lot of trouble for opening my mouth about the obvious. But at any rate, there will be probably the biggest May Day demonstration, certainly, that this country has seen, I'm going to guess, for decades, if not the largest. And people who are interested in struggles and pointing to the issues that they are in solidarity with ought to be in solidarity with that one. Because these are students like the Chileans and the Mexican students are fighting for access to higher education for everyone. And they're fighting the tuition mongers like the New York Times and others who say, well, you know, the U.S., they pay $30,000 a year, so what are you complaining about? We're complaining because we don't want your lousy system. See, we don't even believe, we don't want it. We don't want 1, 2, 3, 4, 10, 30. We don't want a system to be bought by the wealthy. That's what we're complaining about. And you're going to see the biggest demonstration on May Day in modern history in Canada. And there will be people here, I guarantee you, in Toronto won't even mention it. They'll say, oh, boy, that's something. They will call attention to something somewhere, but they won't mention Montreal. Anyway, this is Phil Taylor for Phil Conlon, Jacob Leibovitz, and David Hoyle with our guest today. And, Carol, thank you very much. See you next week.